This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there. We really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. The Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, has ordered a complete overhaul of governance procedures within the party going forward, following the controversy over their former press officer, who we now know is a paedophile, Michael McMonagle. He is currently awaiting sentencing after admitting to charges, including attempting to incite a child into sexual activity. When Sinn Féin knew the story about Michael McMonagle was entering the public domain, they went on the attack, accusing the British Heart Foundation for not doing proper due diligence when they employed McMonagle. Conor Murphy, our economy minister, launched the first attack, and then Michelle O'Neill. Yesterday, the First Minister stood up and apologised.
And I am deeply sorry for the reputational damage caused to the British Heart Foundation. And I regret that this has happened and I apologise for this.
So Michelle O'Neill apologising for it. Michelle O'Neill was summoned before the Assembly yesterday to answer questions over how Sinn Féin had handled the controversy.
Michael McMonagle is a monster. Michael McMonagle did what he did and he's being dealt with under the full force of the law, and rightly so. The two former press officers of Sinn Féin should not have done what they have done. They should not have provided references. They would not have been given permission to give references. I do not condone that by anybody's, and particularly in this kind of case.
So Michelle O'Neill very much taking questions yesterday, apologising. The dangerous message that was put out by Sinn Féin, that if you tip off an employer with information you know, it's a basic fundamental safeguarding message. It's more than a message, it's an instruction. If you have information, tell people. With regards to an employer, there is nothing stopping an employer telling a future employer if it safeguards children. And yet, Conor Murphy attempted to provide reasoning around why Sinn Féin didn't tip off the British Heart Foundation. He was wrong to do so, and Michelle O'Neill admitted this yesterday.
I accept the Chief Constable has clarified his position, and I accept that position.
So now Sinn Féin all of a sudden accept the position. How can we have a party that is running the country along with others? Why did they get into the position where they were destroying a key safeguarding message? Was it party first? Was it because they were protecting Sinn Féin's reputation before making sure that a key safeguarding message was protected? And the photograph. Despite a photograph showing Michelle O'Neill standing just yards away from McMonagle at Stormont, this was February 2023, our First Minister insists she did not see him there.
I'm very confident, and I stand over the fact that I did not see Michael McMonagle in the chamber. I accept that when you look at that photograph from that angle, that it perhaps looks that perhaps I should have seen him. But I did not see Michael McMonagle that day. I would not stand here and make that statement if it were not true. I did not see this individual on that day. I was solely focused on talking to the family and solely focused on the actual reason why they were here in the hall in the first place, which was around trying to get the organ donation legislation over the line.
And as we take your calls this morning, 0330 80 55 55, the First Minister insists that this is way up there, right at the very top of priority for her in terms of her party and her conviction to always safeguard children.
I do take my responsibilities very seriously when it comes to safeguarding. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. Of course, this is something that we right up there in terms of my priority list of issues to be concerned about. I have set out my account of what I knew and when I knew it.
Our political editor, Enda McClafferty, with me this morning. Well, that's a party, very much different tone and apologies, Enda, after trying to stand firm yesterday and attack others.
Yes.
Last week when they were attacking others.
This has been a party struggling to get ahead of this story basically from day one, because this, in a sense, Stephen, was a self-inflicted crisis. And I know there was a great deal of frustration within Sinn Féin that all of this came to the surface. And let's not forget, Stephen, we would not know any of this had it not been for the Sunday World journalist who asked the questions in the first place. This would not be in the public domain. We would not have the week we've just had. There would probably be no internal governance structure overhaul being launched in Sinn Féin right now. But because of what's happened over the course of the past week, it has led to a lot of self-reflection within the party, not least the two big questions. Why did two press officers in the party feel it was okay to give a reference to a man who was under police investigation for child sex offences? And the second big question internally being asked within the party right now is, why did a HR manager who was fully across the McMonagall case, as we now know, and his removal from the party, didn't red flag the fact that the party press team had provided references for him? And how did that happen is the big question. And I think that's probably what Sinn Féin now will be asking internally. And I think we can't escape the fact as well, Stephen, that the very man who would be at the heart of steering the party through this particular crisis is the very man who triggered this crisis. And that's Sean McGeer, who was head of the press operation at Stormont. So for all of these reasons, I think there are lots of questions being asked outside Sinn Féin and within Sinn Féin.
Yeah, are those questions genuinely being asked within Sinn Féin, Enda? And look, they very well may be, and there's no inference from me. Or is this a party scrambling to say anything to protect its reputation?
Well, on the surface, we have to take what Sinn Féin is telling us, Stephen, and that is the fact that they were kept in the dark. They say the leadership at no stage was aware of Michael McMonagall's new employment. We pushed Conor Murphy, you'll see from that interview last week, about this. As you say, he hit back then in terms of what he said others had a responsibility to do as well around all of this, and we now know that record, in a sense, has been corrected as of yesterday. But I do think that the Sinn Féin has been in a difficult place over the past week, and the moment of jeopardy for the party was that photograph in the Great Hall, Stephen, because Michelle O'Neill insisting that she did not see the man who she employed for 2 or 3 months within her office, the man who she knew was suspended from the party and under police investigation. The fact that she didn't see him just yards away in the Great Hall raises lots of questions, and she acknowledged that in her speech yesterday in the chamber, saying people will look on at this and think, how did that happen? The very fact that she did not say that she saw him means that the dots, in a sense, cannot be joined up, because had she admitted to seeing him in the Great Hall, then the questions would have been much bigger for Sinn Féin, because then we could have said to Michelle O'Neill, well, you saw him there, you knew he was with the British Heart Foundation, and yet the party, and you did not alert the charity to the fact that they'd employed a man who was suspended and under police investigation.
Well, look, unless you cannot get inside Michelle O'Neill's head, we've all seen the photograph, but it is possible, it literally is possible, that she didn't see him. And unless we have evidence, and we don't, that she did see him, because we can't get inside her head, then many people might take what she is saying at face value. But there are other questions here. Are we seriously suggesting that a party that knows about nearly everything that moves in Northern Ireland didn't know that their former press officer, suspended for an interest in inciting children to engage in sexual activity, was not working for the British Heart Foundation? Are we seriously to believe that?
Well, that's what the party is telling us, Stephen, and that is what Michelle O'Neill said yesterday at the dispatch box in the chamber as well. So that's their party position, and they're not deviating from that position. But I have to tell you, somebody who was there that day whenever Michael McMonagall showed up at Stormont, he caught my eye because I didn't realise that he was under a new employment. I didn't know he had moved on. I was talking to him that day up there, and he said he just wanted a fresh challenge by working with the British Heart Foundation. Now, it was obvious to all of us who were there that he was there, and he was there in his new role at the British Heart Foundation, and there were lots of Sinn Féin MLAs up at that event as well, and I'm not sure what the conversations were within the party, but from the outside looking in, it is hard to understand how nobody realised that he was now in a new job and he was working for the British Heart Foundation. So those questions won't disappear, Stephen, but I think from Sinn Féin's point of view, they will look at this crisis this morning and they will feel that it is over for them now, because they will look at the stories in the newspapers this morning around Stormont passes and around possible rule breaking around where Michael McMonagall was getting paid from, what public pot of money, and they will see those basically as issues they can deal with. And the bigger question, of course, they think they will be able to move on from this point.
There will be many people who listen to the Nolan Show, Enda, and they are not embroiled in the detail around a Windsor framework or the politics that people who are political geeks do get into, right into the depths of detail. But those very same people are mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers, and they understand the dangers around child abuse. They understand how important it is for us all to protect children. And they will understand that when Sinn Féin last week had a reputational problem with their party, they attacked the British Heart Foundation. They attacked you for even asking questions in terms of your role within the BBC asking them. And they attempted to put out an erroneous message that to tip a future employer off would prejudice a police investigation. Mums and dads, grannies and grandfathers will understand that story, Enda. How does Sinn Féin repair that?
Well, I think that was a party under pressure, Stephen, last week, because they were grappling with all of this, and the fact that this was coming from within was hurting even more. And I think we got an illustration of that whenever there was this pointing at fingers at elsewhere, basically, to the British Heart Foundation and raising questions around due diligence that Sinn Féin say perhaps wasn't carried out within the party. I think that was illustrated in that interview with Conor Murphy. Now, the party might well argue, Stephen, that in the benefit of hindsight, of course, the party would be in a much better position. Back then, Michael McMonagall was accused of something. In the eyes of the law, he was innocent. The party, of course, had a lot of calls to make around all of this. They were perhaps arguing that there was going to prejudice an investigation, which we now know was not the case. The chief constable has made that clear. Conor Murphy challenged me on what I would do in that scenario. Would I have approached the British Heart Foundation to alert them? I says, well, I would have possibly raised a red flag around all of this. He says, well, they took a different point of view back then. So there's lots of issues around this, Stephen, so you can imagine how the questions aren't going to go away anytime soon, but I don't think that this crisis is going to be escalated to the point where it becomes a real problem at the heart of government.
You're saying there are now other questions over how Sinn Féin have used public money to pay for McMonagall, and this is around the very defined, strict rules around what they can use money to pay for. Set this out for us.
Yes, there are two sets, two pots of money, if you like, we're talking about at the heart of this story. So there's a pot of money that the parties can draw from to run their affairs at Stormont, and press officers can be paid from that pot. There's another pot of public money, which is for MLAs to employ their own staff within their own offices to deal with constituency matters, and they can employ their own press team out of that pot. Now, it gets complicated where you have somebody who is essentially employed by an MLA, getting paid through that MLA's office, but yet and all working for the party in a press sense. And that's where the difficulty, I think, comes from Sinn Féin, because from the outside looking in, it looks as if this was the case in relation to Michael McMonagall. Now, the questions will be asked around how this happened. Was there a rule break around all of this? Can Sinn Féin demonstrate that where Michael McMonagall's money was coming from to show that all the rules are being adhered to here? So that's where the question remains, and it's one for the Assembly Commission to perhaps look into. And it was raised yesterday by Philip Brett, of course, in the DUP within the chamber. Now, Sinn Féin might well say, are the public really going to get exercised about which public pot of money was the money drawn down from? It was, in a sense, if it can be demonstrated, a breaking of the rules at Stormont, but I think Sinn Féin will take the view that they can possibly manage this.
The Assembly Commission, finally, and they have said that McMonagall was employed by Michelle O'Neill from the 2nd of March 2020 to the 31st of May 2020, and then by Gemma Dolan, MLA, from the 1st of June 2020 to the 8th of July 2022 in a full-time position. And that's what drew my attention. So the Assembly Commission saying that Gemma Dolan, that McMonagall, was employed in a full-time position by Gemma Dolan. So if that's the case, that money, that public money, our money, better not have been paid to McMonagall for doing a press job, right?
Yes, that's on the surface how you can read that, Stephen, and it's a question that Sinn Féin will be asked and no doubt will have to provide some sort of an answer around that. We will wait and see what the party's response is in all of this, but on the surface it does look as if Michael McMonagall was getting paid from a pot while doing work for another arm of the party where he should have been getting money from a different pot, in the, so to speak. So we'll have to wait and see how all of this plays out, Stephen, but it's a question that's not going to go away.
And a thank you. Morning to you, Alan McQuillan, with us this morning. Good morning to you, Alan.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. You're a former Assistant Chief Constable. If Sinn Féin have been using that money, public money, this is at a time, we're doing this story at a time where we've got winter fuel payments being cancelled for pensioners, where we've got Keith Archibald, the Sinn Féin Finance Minister, may very well be issuing, you know, hard messages about what we can no longer pay for. If Sinn Féin have been diverting our public money to for their press operation, what again should happen?
Well, more important to being in the place, I was a member of the panel that used to set the rules at Stormont. And our last determination was in 2016. And when we ceased to exist in 2016, there should have been a new panel appointed, but the Assembly never got around to it. So for 8 years, they started to chip away at the rules that were in place. But the rules that were in place were very clear. The money that is provided to members is for members' use in their constituencies, serving their constituents as an MLA. And I know we took the view that they didn't need a press officer. You know, they're politicians, they had the party press operation, and as an MLA and a constituency dealing with constituency problems, they generally didn't need a press officer. There's also the press facilities of the Assembly itself open to them. So there were tight rules drawn around that. Now, we last published a report in 2016 setting out those rules. So those rules are in a legal document that is legally enforceable that defines how money is. The Assembly put out an amendment to that in 2016 where they added some of their own rules into it. But so far as I understand, the fundamentals haven't changed. And if anybody's working for an MLA, they should be working for an MLA, working for him and that, or her and that constituency.
Well, the Assembly Commission have said, and the dates have read out, that McMonagall was working for Gemma Dolan full-time.
So that would be fine if he was working for Gemma Dolan full-time as a constituency MLA. But, you know, everything that's been said so far seems to suggest he was just part of the party press team.
So should the police investigate this? Should it be Edwin Poots, the Speaker, investigating this? Whose role is it to investigate this use of public money?
It's the role of the Assembly Commission, because technically you could argue that payments in this sort of circumstances were ultra vires. But you'll never get anything done, because it's down to the Assembly Commission. They're the guardians of what goes on in the Assembly, and that's one member, senior member from each of the main parties sitting together. And you know that they will never at any time authorise an investigation in this. And when in the past, when we did exist and we identified quite a significant number of breaches of the rules, the Assembly Commission always met and said, that's okay, but we will try and recover the money, just let it go. Learn for the future.
Just let it go?
Yeah. They never took enforcement action against any cases, even when MLS had worked the system or taken money from the system.
But this is,
they never pursued it.
But look, beyond this case, and we need to get more detail, we need to hear from Sinn Féin what their position is on this. So let's separate this case from wider misuse of public money. You're suggesting you wrote the rules and your experience is the Assemblies Commission says just let it go. They're not just letting it go when they're cancelling money to pensioners here for winter fuel. That decision centrally taken by Keir Starmer, but decided here in this local executive. They don't just let people's bills go here. This is our money.
Well, their attitude towards that can be gauged by the fact it's 9 years. They first of all, in a blaze of publicity, were setting up an independent body to set our expense rules. And we had a lot of support from a lot of people at that time. And don't just blame Sinn Féin in this, because it was other parties were at it as well. I remember another party at that stage was levying a bill of, I think it was £6,000 or £8,000 per year in every one of their members to fund the party's central costs. So, you know, it wasn't just Sinn Féin doing this. A number of the parties were at it. But we put in rules, we put in systems to try and responsibly and sensibly do this. 9 years ago, almost, we ceased to exist. They've never replaced us.
Alan, stay there for me, if you can. John's our first call from Hillsborough. Morning, John.
Hello.
Go ahead, John.
I just want to go back a wee bit in reference to Michelle O'Neill. Up front, at full face value, giving an apology. But, okay, she's done that. She's put her neck on the block over the head of this, which, if you follow it through, could possibly cost her job. My question would be is, what's happened to Mr. Murphy? He's gone very quiet.
Now, there's been no apology from him, is your point?
Yeah. He's very much out of the spotlight now, where he was one of the main attackers between him and, actually, probably him more than the team.
John, thank you for your call. It's hard to hear you because you're on that car phone, but thank you for your call. Alison Morris with us this morning from the Belfast Telegraph. Does this draw a line under this, Alison? What Michelle did yesterday? What the First Minister did?
Well, I think as far as Sinn Féin are concerned, that they believe that this is the end of their participation in it, but the story itself obviously does not have a line drawn under it. Michael McMonagall hasn't even been sentenced yet. He's due in court again in November. Clearly, given the high profile around this case, there'll be a lot of news attention will be focused around that. And also, I suppose, like everybody else, I was glad to hear that there was several people yesterday when they spoke mentioned the victims in this, because there are four children who are victims of Michael McMonagall, who I'm sure their families have been watching all this in distress and traumatised by it all, because they're having to deal with obviously the aftermath of their young children being abused and then everything that's happening since. So it was, I think it was, in terms of someone like myself who works on crime and security and deals with a lot of victims of abuse, that was really welcome. Sinn Féin's part in it, I know that you're discussing today about who, what pot Michael McMonagall was paid out of. Well, I doubt very much you'll hear too much of the political parties, other political parties, making too much of a fuss about that, because they all have arrangements that go on up in Stormont with the hiring of relatives and all sorts of other things, but they don't like to push on that door too hard, given the fact it might come back on them at some stage. The apology, I think, from Michelle O'Neill was probably about as fulsome as it's going to get. I do agree maybe that Conor Murphy needs to come out and explain why he was so defensive on those early days. But the issue of this, there's several parts of learning have to be taken from this. First of all, and the most important one, is the child protection aspect and what we do in terms of child protection, because this is not the first time that we have had a political scandal involving child abuse and senior politicians. And you know something, it may well not even be the last. You know, there may be other cases, because paedophiles are very dangerous and devious people and they hide in plain sight. And the fact is, there could well be other scandals coming down the line, but it's how you handle those. And the handling of this, especially in those first few days, I don't think anyone in Sinn Féin even would argue that it was well handled. The communications were terrible. Is that because of them to say it? The person who would usually be dealing with this, the person who would usually be their troubleshooter, who would be managing the press response, is actually the person
who caused
this,
Alison, but this, Alison, in terms of managing a response, that's about, you know, who you give that message to, how concise you are, how it punches through with the rest of a news agenda around it, as you know. That's not what this was about. This was about Conor Murphy deliberately, proactively attempting to place a message in the public domain that it would prejudice a police investigation, and the obvious questions that flow through that for a party in government. Why wouldn't you check even if you did believe it? And how could they have believed it? Why didn't they check with the police before they said it? Such a damaging message for safeguarding in our country. Why did the lead party in government, the biggest party, not the lead party, the biggest party, why did they not check with the police?
I think the fact is that most of us who would work in this field would know that you cannot prejudice an investigation by simply being what was known as a whistleblower.
It was nonsense.
And saying, look, I have concerns about this. And you know, we do keep on saying that there was many opportunities missed here. Not only should someone in Sinn Féin, well, they shouldn't have credited the references in the first place. That's a completely different thing. But if we go on to what happened then after that, the fact was that McMonagall was in both in Stormont and in Westminster on two separate occasions while he was under investigation, albeit he hadn't been charged anything at that stage, but it was in the advanced stages of the investigation. You know, we've said this before and I'll say it again, you cannot expect a sex offender, a paedophile, to do the right thing. You know, they're devious, they're cunning, they're blatant, they're brazen, they're all of those things. So it's up to other people to protect the public from those kind of devious people. And in this case, the public was not protected from them. It should have been raised, even if it was done quietly by a phone call or a conversation in the corner of the Great Hall. It should have been raised with the British Heart Foundation. And, you know, Fergal McKinney has come out and spoke about that. He's an ex-journalist and an ex-politician. And there was plenty of opportunities and contacts with people who knew him both professionally and personally, who could have mentioned that to him. I also think that the fact that Sinn Féin don't actually lose members like that, you know, Sinn Féin members are also party members as well as staff members, and it would have raised even questions. I can't even believe that even in the coffee room in Stormont, nobody said, why did he leave Sinn Féin? You know, why did he move on? You know, what's he doing working for the British Heart Foundation?
And that, just two more points, questions, Alison. So after Conor Murphy had harmed the British Heart Foundation by hitting out at them, suggesting that they had not done enough due diligence, our First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, saw that damage. And then she chose to repeat it, nearly word for word. Why would she do that?
Well, I mean, that goes back to what we're talking about the management of this at the start. There is issues when you come to crisis management and dealing with something like this. And every political party has had their scandals over the years, and some have dealt with it better than others. The easiest way to do it is just to be upfront and honest, you know, to attack it just as it is, and say, what do we know? And there should have been conversations with Sinn Féin behind scenes saying, what do we know, rather than everyone coming out with a different version of what was going on and being upfront and honest. It took over, I think yesterday was probably as fulsome as that's going to get, but it took too long for that to become a reality. Okay. I think that the automatic response was defence at the start, and that has proven to be something that has kept this in the public eye a lot longer than maybe it would have dealt with properly at the start.
Final question. Within this interview this morning, you have referred to four children who are the victims of McMonagall. And I'm clearly completely confused, Alison, because I thought this was a police sting operation where they posed as a child and McMonagall pursued that person online thinking it was a child. There are actual real children at the centre of this. Are there, Alison? Can you help me with that?
It's my understanding, from the time when they first appeared in court, it's my understanding that there are actual children involved in this. And from looking at the charge sheet, that when he was appearing in court to enter his guilty plea, and remember, this man has tried to avoid appearing in court on at least two different occasions, he hasn't showed up. It's my understanding that there's actual children involved in this.
Okay. Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph. Thank you. If you've been affected by any of the issues, bbc.co.uk/actionline, the Nexus number. They offer a specialised professional counselling service to people impacted by sexual abuse. 90 32 6803 is their number. We'll pause for a second. We'll get the news from the BBC. Alan McQuillan, I've asked you to stay on this morning, and you're still there, Alan.
Yes.
And Alex Kane, you're joining us as well, former Director of Communications for the Youth Party. Morning to you, Alex.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Alan, there's another aspect to this case where, you know, I'm hearing people are talking to me about it. And I just want to ask about the procedures. So, obviously, the police will have seized Mick Monagle's phones, okay, as part of their investigation into him. That's standard practice when they were investigating Mick Monagle. Now, he turned out to be a paedophile. How will the police have investigated those phones, given the fact that he was suspected at the stage they were looking into the phones and there would have been sensitive political information on those phones belonging to Sinn Féin? How do the police do that when it's someone, you know, within politics?
Well, Stephen, there's no specific provision I'm aware of in relation to the protection of political information. So it would be down to the normal duties of a police officer to deal properly with confidential information belonging to anybody. But if it was a legal information or getting advice from solicitors or things like that, then what they would normally do is bring in a barrister and give all the data to the barrister and let the barrister take out of it any material that they shouldn't have access to.
So for example, and look, we don't know, but if Mick Monagle was so depraved that, you know, to the extent that he's inciting, attempting to incite children into sex abuse, I wonder what from that Sinn Féin phone he was tweeting. I wonder if he was attacking other people who were opponents of Sinn Féin. We've seen the trolling campaigns that have been around politics for a long time. I don't know, but if the police did discover any evidence around that, what would they do with it? Or if they weren't investigating that, would they do nothing with it?
Well, when you're investigating the activities of an individual, what I would expect them to normally do is to look for any evidence in that of offences. And if they come across evidence of something else, for example, let's suppose he was buying drugs or he was involved in something else, they would just hoover that up and that would form part of the investigation. That would be the normal process. But if it was a political issue about, you know, trolling online, provided it wasn't illegal, that's not of interest to the police.
Okay. And we don't know, but I'm just posing the question, what else was on that phone? Who did the phones belong to? Alex Kane, did the phones belong to Mick Monagle or were they Sinn Féin phones? Should we know
Morning, Steve. Well, some phones will be. I don't know. It's been a long time since I've worked up there, but quite often in the press office, you would be given a phone which would be basically, it belonged to the party, it was through the press office and so on. But that doesn't stop people having their own private phones, making calls through that. So that's going to be difficult. The phone that, I mean, I don't know whether the police just get the party phones. This is the phone that would be used for doing your work and things like that, and maybe conversations between people in the press office, or whether they would also have access, I mean, Alan would know that, whether they would also have access to his private phone, which might have entirely different stuff. Might be some party-related stuff, but it might be stuff that wasn't connected, that he hadn't been authorised to do. He was using a private call for some other, you know, I'm not talking about the case for the children, so I'm just talking about maybe if they were doing things, trolling or organising campaigns against certain people on Twitter and so on.
Now, we don't know, Alex, but would they have looked at...
The police and the barrister will have, as Alan says, things will be hoovered up on your people's phones, and they will know what's relevant to what they're looking at.
You also will see, if the police are pursuing an investigation as serious as this, they'll also want to hoover up all the phones he has access to.
Yes, that's right.
So the police would have taken all the phones, both owned by Sinn Féin, related to McMonagall, and his personal computer equipment, would they?
And they should have. And also, there's the phones that are funded by the Assembly. Because, again, the provisions we put in place, each member was entitled to a package of phones which were procured on a contract through the Assembly to ensure we got the best value. I don't know if they're still doing it that way, but the Assembly procured a package and an MLA said, right, I'll have two iPads and three phones. And then that was then recharged to their expenses.
Alex Kane, do you think, Alan, thank you, good morning to you. Alex, do you think that Stormont will move on now?
I think it will, Stephen. I mean, the case is difficult. I think it is worth remembering, because I think when I first spoke to you about this last week, more or less after the story had broken, I said the big problem for any party is when at the heart of the issue they're dealing with, it's the press office, because it's the press office which protects the party, promotes the party, firefights on behalf of the party. And I think that's why they have been stumbling about with wobbly, ambiguous, vague statements, because they don't entirely know. Because in this case, it seems clear that the senior figure, I'm not justifying anything any of them have said and done since then, but there seems to be increasing evidence that senior figures within the political wing of the party weren't entirely sure of some of the stuff that people in the press office were. I think that's why they have a huge problem. In terms of the damage it will do, we know, Stephen, if we go back to 2016 when the over the RHI, when Sinn Féin got very exercised with Arlene Foster's role, DUP wouldn't move her, Sinn Féin stood Martin down, wouldn't have nominated. You had the same in 22. I don't think we're getting to that point, but I think there will be some people within unionism. It will suit them, Stephen. I'm not specifying, I just simply said, I think that not just unionism, maybe other parties as well, it will suit them to see Sinn Féin discomforted at the moment.
Alex, thank you very much indeed. Next, yesterday marked a year since the attacks on October the 7th, which claimed over 1,200 lives. Since then, nearly 42,000 people have been killed during Israel's campaign in Gaza, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. I've been speaking at the weekend to Professor Mohammad Marandi, an academic from the University of Tehran, who advised the Iranian government during nuclear negotiations. I began by asking him how ordinary Iranians felt about the situation at the moment.
The sympathies of ordinary Iranians are with the Palestinians and the Lebanese. There is no sympathy for the Israeli regime or the ideology of Zionism.
Well, there must be sympathy for those Israelis who are equally human beings who have lost their loved ones and their children in this war.
I think that is not a very meaningful statement. There's sympathy for human beings, but there's no sympathy for people who consider themselves to be a chosen people and who consider others to be Amalek, thus subhuman. So it's like saying that there must be sympathy for the white supremacists in South Africa who give casualties in fighting the native black Africans.
Well, it's not. You would concede, wouldn't you, that in this war there are innocent victims, there are massive amounts of people on both sides who are not military personnel, and they're being killed, and they're being buried alive, and children are dying on both sides.
I think, again, you are carrying a lot of water for Zionism. It is much worse than apartheid South Africa. South Africans who lived through apartheid say that the Israeli regime is much worse than the supremacist regime in South Africa. Desmond Tutu said that himself after visiting Palestine. And Israel considers itself to be a regime where everyone is a soldier. I find it absurd that on the one hand, the Israelis, they're constantly talking about how all their youth are in uniform and the women and men are all fighting, a part of the fighting force. But when those men and women are killed, everyone is suddenly an innocent victim. Yet they use bunker busters to bring down apartment buildings on a daily basis. And then
they're using bunker busters to target terrorists.
Well, the terrorists are in London because they are supporting the regime and they're helping them militarily and politically. So yes, the real terrorists are definitely in London and in Tel Aviv. And those people who are under the rubble right now, thanks to people like yourself, the truth is hidden from the public, if that is indeed what you're trying to imply.
Yeah, I'm interviewing you, Mohammed, as a journalist. You know nothing about me. There's no point wasting time now starting to target me. So let's get on with the interview about what's happening.
No,
in Iran,
but if it's a waste of time, then we can just end this. What you're saying is absurd, that they are using bunker busters to kill terrorists. You know that's not true. You know it. I have no doubt that you know this. I have no doubt that everyone in that room and in the studio knows this. So why do you say it?
So the Israeli regime
just came back from Lebanon. Go and look at my Twitter account. Go and look at my Twitter. I did a tour of southern Beirut just the day before yesterday. I went, there were six, in just one of the places I went to, go and look at the footage. There were six towers that were leveled to the ground. Six towers right beside another. A whole block wiped out. And then you're saying they're bombing terrorists? They're the terrorists. And then you're telling me this? It's like unbelievable that anyone can even say such a thing.
Can I ask you this, Professor Morandi? You're an academic from the University of Tehran. How is this situation to be de-escalated? What needs to happen, do you think?
There are two types of de-escalation. One is that there has to be a permanent ceasefire that's acceptable to the resistance in Gaza and to the people of Lebanon. Two, an end to the conflict has to include an end to racial hierarchy, ethno-supremacism. Palestinians have to be equal human beings. I know that is not acceptable in the West. You believe that in your country people should have equal rights, but you find it to be unacceptable, not you personally, but your government finds it to be unacceptable that Palestinians should have equal rights to Israelis.
And how do you know, Professor, how what is your calculation as to how Israelis should feel secure if there is to be de-escalation? We're coming up to a year's anniversary now of October the 7th, when innocent men, women and children were kidnapped, were assaulted and were murdered. So how can ordinary innocent Israelis feel safe if there is to be a ceasefire?
I don't know how many people were innocent there. That I don't know, because I don't think you know either. Israelis who are
You do know it was a music festival. You do know that young people and very elderly people who can barely walk were assaulted and kidnapped. You do know that.
I think you do know that it was a rave, and it was beside the apartheid wall, and behind that wall were Palestinians that have been expelled from their land, including where the rave was held, and those Palestinians were living in a concentration camp since they were born. And you do know that at 5 a.m. at a rave, they are all young adults. And young adults are the people who serve in the armed forces of the Israeli regime. So it's not as if they're a bunch of 14-year-olds out on a beach at six in the afternoon.
They were not serving those people at that rave.
They were of military age. They were all of. Were kids at a rave at 5 a.m.
Being of military age is were not. Kids at, being were kids in at the rave, military, and you know it.
Were kids
so
at
look,
the rave?
Let's try to move this
were kids
forward.
At the rave? No, answer me. I sincerely want to know. Were kids at the rave?
I don't even know what your point is.
And why are you saying this? How do you know they're adults? You do know that all men and women in Israel serve in the armed forces. You do
Here's
know that those
you.
That every all adults are reservists in their youth.
Here's what I want to ask you. I want to ask you equally as to how citizens who you want to feel safe, how can citizens in Israel feel safe? How can they be guaranteed that October the 7th
easy.
Will not happen again?
It's very easy. End apartheid. Like in South Africa, the supremacists in South Africa recognize that white supremacy was not sustainable. Ethno-supremacism in Palestine is not sustainable. End the apartheid system. End the racial hierarchy. But that's not something that the West would accept. Because in your country, multiculturalism used to be a thing. But when it comes to Palestine, it's outrageous.
It was only last night that you said on Twitter, Iran is waiting for an excuse to crush the Zionist regime.
If they strike Iran, Iran will hammer them very hard, have no doubt.
Who do you think should be crushed? Who do you agree should be crushed?
Anyone who slaughters women and children and brings down apartment blocks and apartment towers full of women and children inside who die under the rubble. They should
Is that Hezbollah? Does that include Hezbollah and Hamas?
No, that includes that only includes your allies. That only includes the people who you pay your taxes to help.
Hezbollah and Hamas are deemed by the British government as a terrorist regime. We've seen what they do to people.
No, I've lived in Lebanon. Hezbollah does not do that. And the white man does not tell us who's the terrorist. That era is over, my friend. Your government does not dictate to us what is a terrorist and what is not a terrorist. That's 19th century old stuff.
So
finished.
How would you describe Hezbollah and Hamas?
Hezbollah was created as a result of a previous Israeli invasion of Lebanon, where they took Beirut, and where in one act, they slaughtered 4,000 Palestinians in the Sabra Shatila camp. Hezbollah was born as a result of that occupation. And when Hezbollah was born, it began the resistance against the Israeli regime and ultimately expelled it from Lebanon in the year 2000.
The primary goal for Hezbollah is the elimination of the state of Israel.
That's right.
That's the primary goal of Hezbollah. Does that mean the elimination of the people who live in Israel? Where do they go?
It's just like apartheid South Africa.
I'm asking you where do they go, those people?
I'm giving you the example. I'm giving you your answer. Where did the white South Africans go? They stayed there. They continued to live there.
You will understand that Israel, according to many different commentators who we're hearing from, is a mightier force, is a more powerful force than the Iranian force. The capability of the war machines within the Iranians and the Israeli regime. So we understand the potential here for danger and for death within both sides. Would you welcome a deal? Would you welcome a peace deal?
I think your analysis is based upon wishful thinking by people in the West who have power and who have control over the narrative. The Israeli regime is weak and puny. Everything that it has comes from the West. All of these bunker busters, all of these jets, everything comes from the West. It is totally dependent. But if the Israeli regime escalates again, and the escalation between Iran is, and the, this regime was initiated by the regime by bombing our embassy and then by carrying out an assassination in Tehran. Both Iran strikes were response, and they were response. They were responses to create deterrence. But if the Israeli regime strikes again, you shall see that Iran will hit much harder than it did a few days ago.
And the Israeli regime. But what would that mean? I've asked you repeatedly about de-escalation.
Deterrence.
Well, you say deterrence. Others might argue provocation. When does this end?
Is it not the
cleverer discussion to talk about de-escalating rather than
de-escalating can only happen when your problem is that when the Israelis attack, you don't consider that an escalation. You consider that self-preservation and protection.
Who do you mean?
I mean yourself and the BBC and this narrative that the BBC repeats day and night, 24 hours a day. We know what the BBC says. We know what the Western media... You work at the BBC, so I don't know you personally. That's what the BBC says. That's what your organization says.
It's not. Usually
what happens when I am interviewed on the BBC, because obviously you're very hostile. You're very pro-Israel and very hostile in this interview.
I'm not.
And what you're saying is, what you're saying is that the Israelis are innocent and the Hamas are terrorists.
Bunker busters are used to
kill terrorists and all that, which I find outrageous. I think we should
Iran's Supreme Leader has claimed.
I think we don't need to continue with this. I don't think you're seriously intervening.
I think the BBC is being criticized by
a newspaper that has attacked me, and now you're trying to make up for it. That's how I see it. Otherwise, the language you're using is not reasonable.
You've been accused by three Jewish leaders this week of making grotesque anti-Semitic slurs.
So that's what it's all about. See, I know you better than what you think.
How do you respond to those accusations?
Well, I think anyone who looks at my tweets can tell.
Do you feel that the people listening to this might be more sympathetic to the points you're trying to make if you were equally talking about how there are many, many innocent people on all sides of this conflict, that humanity is suffering, that children, no matter what age they are, which country they're living in,
do you think they
might be more sympathetic to what you're saying if you were to answer that in the affirmative by saying, yes, there are too many innocent civilians being killed, and let's de-escalate.
That statement is irrelevant. That doesn't mean anything. No one wants children to die. But your government and people like yourself are responsible for the situation that we're in. And your media is basically supporting the narrative of your government.
Okay. Professor, what the BBC will do, we'll have many journalists from all different backgrounds on the ground looking impartially at what is happening without fear or favour.
I don't think you believe in that.
and that's what
that's not what they do.
United Kingdom. And thank you very much.
Because I'm also recording this. I just want you to answer my question.
Why didn't you answer my question?
Is it difficult?
Professor, thank you.
Is it difficult to answer my question?
Thank you very much.
Is it difficult? Will it get you into trouble to answer my question?
Good night.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.